Yes. I've survived Corona already.
Hello, Chief.
Hello.
I hope you're well.
Good morning. And how are you guys?
Good. How are you, Chi? I miss you guys so much, eh?
Hey, I miss you. I miss you. So can we start our meeting? Can we play a little bit?
Again.
Yeah. Can we play a little bit, ne, honorable members?
Yeah, thank you. Thank you so much, Chair.
Yeah. Chair. Yeah, let's start with prayer.
Okay.
Yeah.
Good morning, Chairperson, honorable members and guests.
Thank you. Can you start?
Yes, Chair, we can start. Okay, it's 1 minute to go on my side, but I guess we can start.
If my watch is working. Okay. No. That's fine. I think we can start. Good morning, honorable members of the committee, support staff. Good morning, National Treasury Team. Joyce Mampu leading the team. Maddie Jane. Yeah, welcome to our meeting, members of the media, members of the public. Good morning. We are most welcome. Today we are getting a briefing from National Treasury on the MTPS bills that were presented by the minister, which must serve before this committee. The bills that will be briefed on are the Division of Revenue Amendment Bill, the Adjustment Appropriation Bill, ESCOM Debt Relief Amendment Bill. So you can see, honorable members, we've got three bills to take care of before Parliament rises. So it's important that we become more efficient. National Treasury, you throw this last moment on us. We knew that we were going to deal with DORAP and the Adjustments Appropriation Bill. Boom, ESCOM Debt Relief Amendment Bill. So we need to try and accommodate that bill. As you know, that this we've got just 1 month to take care of all the bills and so the NCOP. Yeah, without further waste of time, I'll allow National Treasury to present on all the bills, right? Let's say 1 hour. If we don't finish, we'll see how we progress. Thank you very much. Let's see who's starting from National Treasury.
Thank you. Sorry, Chairperson.
Yeah,
you may have forgotten about the apologies. We have one apology from Mr. Sarupen.
Yeah, okay. Let's note that apology, honorable members. Yeah, thanks, Terry. National Treasury, I'll only hear from you at 2 minutes past 10. Thank you.
Thank you, Honorable Chair. I don't seem to see my picture. I don't know what is going on. Am I visible?
No, the picture.
Okay.
Oh, then.
All right. Okay. Good morning, Honorable Chair. So we will take you through the bills. We'll start with the Division of Revenue Bill, which Bongani and Letsepa will take you through that very quickly. And the Mampo will lead the appropriation bill, and Ravesh would lead the ESCOM and amendment bill. So over to you, Bongani.
Thank you very much, Mama Dijeng. Good morning, Honorable Chairperson and honorable members of the committee and colleagues. I'm going to try to share my screen. I'm hoping that maybe...
Bongani, you may switch off your video. It's not very clear. So, yeah. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Honorable Chairperson. I will try to share my screen. so that we can project the presentation. I'm not sure if the presentation is showing on your side.
Yes, it is.
Okay, thank you very much, Chairperson. As indicated, we are here to brief the committee on the 2023 Division of Revenue Amendment Bill. And what we are going to be talking to are the changes to the schedule, changes to provincial and local government allocation, and changes to gazetted conditional grants and allocation. And we'll also touch on what was presented in the 2020 MTBPS for the 2024 Division of Revenue. In terms of the changes that we are presenting here, initially during in February, the minister tabled the main Division of Revenue, which was enacted and became Act Number 5 of 2023. And when the act only includes the clauses and the schedules. However, everything else that is contained in the bill has to be gazetted, which the minister did in terms of Section 15 of the act, but that excludes the explanatory memorandum. So the bill, the main act to a large extent, remains as is. However, there are changes that we are making, hence the tabling of the Division of Revenue Amendment Bill, which is Bill 33 of 2023. And this, in terms of the changes that are included in the bill, they are guided by Section 30, Subsection 2 of the PFMA, whereby since the tabling of the main budget, there have been changes to the fiscal framework, or it has deteriorated, which the minister indicated when during the MTBPS, and that warranted for some changes to allocations to provinces and local government, which we are going to be talking to today. And also there were some unforeseen and avoidable expenditure, which would mainly be talking to things like responding to disasters. So those are some of the changes that we are going to be talking to in this presentation. The Division of Revenue Amendment Bill, we are not changing the whole schedule that was included in the main bill, but we are only changing column A, which is the numbers that are showing allocations for the current financial year. So in our changes, we are showing the main allocation, adjusted adjustment, and the adjusted allocation. And the schedules that have been amended, Schedule 1, 2, 3, and 4A, B, and C, 5A, B, and C, 6A, B, and Schedule 7B. In terms of the changes to the provincial allocations during the MTBPS or in-year changes, since the agreement of the 2023-24 wages, additional funding has been added to the provincial equitable share. And this is to assist provinces, mainly the Department of Health and Education, to implement that wage agreement. And the amount that has been added is 17.6 billion. And this then takes the original equitable share that was 568 billion to 585 billion. So this means then the money has been added to assist provinces to implement this wage for the departments that are mostly personnel heavy. And then in terms of the reprioritizations that have happened, in the school backlog infrastructure grant, 57 million has been reprioritized. This money, about 32 million of it, is to deal with the compensation of employees, pressure, and 25 million is to deal with the upgrades to the ICT systems. And then there was a rollover also within the school infrastructure backlog grant. And this rollover, it was for a sanitation appropriate for school initiative, which deals with inappropriate structures in schools. And the other one was the ACD. And Moreover, 18 million of that money is to deal with the management cost of the grant. So the provinces where this the provinces where that will be receiving this rollover funding are schools in Eastern Cape, KwaZulu-Natal, and Limpopo. So in terms of the reductions that were done in here, the equitable share was protected from reductions. However, reductions were made to the provincial conditional grants. And in that process, we try to protect as much as possible programs that are important, such as the early childhood development and the school nutrition program, to ensure that the poor children still get the nutritious meal that they are supposed to without being affected by these changes. And to that extent, even for the early childhood development, the school infrastructure backlog grant was reduced by a bigger amount to accommodate a reduction that should have been done to the early childhood development grant. But in terms of the reduction for the direct conditional grants, the reduction totals 6.2 billion. And for the indirect grant, it's 317 million. And the total of the two is 6.5 billion. And just to indicate that that money that is reduced for the indirect grant, the school backlog infrastructure grant, also includes the reprioritization that we spoke about earlier. I will hand over to my colleague, Letsepa Papakis, to take the committee through the rest of the presentation. Thank you very much, Chairperson and honorable members of the committee.
Good morning, Chairperson and the honorable members. I will quickly take you through the changes to the local government allocations. Next slide, Bongani. So here, honorable members, we had put funds unallocated in the local government equitable share. So this was to ensure that we compensate municipalities should the ESCOM and NERSA a process result in a bigger bulk increase than what we had put in the formula. Unfortunately for us, that pressure didn't materialize, so that money has been declared as an expenditure. The disasters that have occurred have really resulted in additional 1.2 billion that has been added to the municipal disaster recovery grant for those floods that took place in February and March across the many provinces where these municipalities are, and as a result of the pressures that have emanated from these disasters, we've also replenished the municipal disaster response grant with 370 million. There have been some conversions in terms of the allocations in the municipal infrastructure grant, one for Otupela municipality and the other one for Mfuleni municipality. This is where these two municipalities have indicated challenges in terms of implementation capacity, and therefore have requested the Department of Cooperative Governance to implement these projects on their behalf. The same has happened in terms of the Neighborhood Development Partnership Grant, where the municipalities have requested the Treasury to then implement that particular program on their behalf. Next slide, Bongani. Thanks. And obviously, the DMR as a department has been facing quite a number of issues around the ownerless mines. So they have reprioritized 53 million from the INFS component to be able to deal with some of those. And there's also a reprioritization in terms of the indirect grants within the Department of Water and Sanitation. This is to help them deal with some contractual obligations between those indirect grants. So they've shifted money between the RPIC as well as the WASIC there. Next slide, Bongani. And then the slide really shows the adjustments that took place. So as you can see, there were no reductions to the equitable share what was allocated to municipalities. However, in terms of the conditional grants, direct conditional grants were reduced by 2.4 billion. I think in the main, I think one of the grants that took the biggest share of that was the public transport network grant, which struggles, continues to struggle in terms of spending there. But there was also space for cuts to be made in the urban settlement development grant, as well as the MEEP, and as you can see also, the ESCOM INEP grant also had a reduction of about 250 million. And these reductions, Honorable Chair and members, were made in these grants, large as they are, but we don't anticipate that they will affect service delivery because of the persistent challenges in terms of expenditure in and around this part. And here, Honorable Members, I'm going to take you through some of the changes in terms of the framework. So Section 15 of the Division of Revenue does require that we consult with yourselves whenever there are any changes to the grant framework, whether we are correcting for an error or an omission. So in the case where we have added the 1.2 billion in terms of the recovery grant for local government, we've also changed the framework so that we can be able to ring fence this money to ensure that it actually goes to the targeted municipalities that are ready to spend this money. The same principle really applies in terms of trying to ensure that funds follow the function. So in the Western Cape government, there was a change in terms of the departments. So we're just ensuring that the 3 million and the 4 million there is actually allocated to the correct latest department there, which is the Provincial Department of Public Works and Infrastructure. There is an error that we are correcting in terms of the indirect regional fund, infrastructure fund, where 20 million was allocated erroneously to Beyers Naudé municipality in the Eastern Cape, and now that is being corrected, and this money will then be reflected as going to Sandys River, where the project actually is. So the municipality is well aware of this, and because it's an indirect grant, it is the department that will be spending those funds on the behalf of the municipality. I have lots of the slides, Bongani. So maybe I'm going to try and protect from my side if can you bring back the slide on maybe the issues on my side only? I'll pass the slide. Next slide, Mangani. Oh yes. Please go back. I may have missed this. I've spoken to both of those.
That's where on this slide. So if you are finished, just go to next one then.
Yes, I'm finished, Honorable Chair. Move to the next slide, Mangani. I'm not going to dwell on this one, Honorable Members, but it really shows, you know, where the changes are. So we showed that the amended frameworks are shown in Annex B of the bill and the changes to provincial allocation, and then specify what changes in terms of the allocations, but also as in terms of the framework. Next slide, Mangani. So here I'm going to be taking you through the proposed changes in terms of the division of revenue over the 2024 MTF as presented in at MPBS. Here, Honorable Members, again, I mean, it's just to note, as we always make a point, indicate that, you know, funds follow the function, hence 48% is allocated to national to deal with some of the national pressures, which include, you know, higher education, police, defense, and more recently, I think, of the SRD. So the share for provinces there, which is 42.1% to deal with the provincial functions, with costs associated with that, and the local government is getting 9.9%. And this is owing to their own revenue-raising powers that they've been afforded, which then helps them to then be able to augment the national fiscal strain. So this is after we have taken into account, honourable members, some downward adjustments in terms of the provincial share, which amount to 4.1 billion. So this is a net addition. So after you would have heard about the reduction, but there's a net reduction, a net increase in terms of the provincial equitable share owing to the challenges that are being experienced in the education and the health sectors. So there's an addition of 4.1 billion there. And then in terms of the conditional funds, so there it's a net reduction of 6.6 billion rand over the next 3 years in terms of the provincial conditional funds. And then in terms of the local government, the equitable share is being reduced by 5.9 billion. So that those would be from the numbers that we presented to yourselves earlier in the year. So that's the change that can be expected. And the fuel levy as well. Currently, there's a reduction of about 3.3 billion in those 3 years. Where also we do see that the conditional funds, direct conditional funds to local government, are also reduced by 2.1 billion. So the details here will be provided in the main budget. And then this honourable member should be looked at in terms of some of the challenges that government continues to face in terms of the debt service cost, which is quite large now. So over the MTF, which is in the last year of the MTF, 2026-27, where it's projected to be around 456 billion, which is really large. So these fiscal consolidation reductions were necessary to ensure that we keep it to that. Next slide, Bongani. So these are really some of the proposed changes. The honourable members should just be reminded that this budget process was made clear that there will be limited changes to conditional funds because of the conditional funds review that is currently underway. So we could only introduce the changes that are consistent with the principles that have been sent out for the grants review, but also those that are quite limited in terms of scope. So here we're talking about in the health provincial grants, there is a new component, which is the health systems component, which comes from the merger of the two components in terms of the National Health Insurance Indirect Grant, which is the personal services component, as well as the non-personal services component. So this is to improve the management of the grant, as it makes it easier for the department, in fact, as a sector as a whole, to manage that particular grant. There's also the streamlining of the oncology funding there, as the honourable members would know that it is mainly funded from the PEF, as well as the National Tertiary Services Grant there. So there's a move to then consolidate the funds for oncology within the NHI direct grant. In terms of the local government, we there's quite a lot of work that is being done by the Department of Water and Sanitation in terms of the regulatory frameworks. So we're trying to complement the work they're doing so that we can ensure that there is improved services. So this involves looking at the urban settlement fund as well as the integrated development fund and the municipal infrastructure to see how, you know, those can be used to then respond to some of the assessments that are coming from the Green Corp and the Blue Corp and North Corp assessment. Now, next slide, Mungani. Okay, that sums it up. Honourable members, thank you very much for your time and thank you, Member Chair.
Dr.
Modise. Thank you, Mema Dijen. Good morning, honorable members. Good morning, Chairperson. I just want to quickly share my presentation. Thank you. So, Chairperson, I'm just going to quickly take the committee through. I'm just trying to view this thing properly. Sorry, Chair. Thank you. Chairperson, quickly, we're looking at the Adjustments Appropriation Bill. And the first couple of slides are just the introductory slides that highlight the process for Parliament, highlight the process of the changes of the bill, if the committee is proposing any changes of the bill. So I'll just get to the core of what we're presenting today. So basically the first item, Chairperson and honorable members, that I want to take the committee through would be the item on the adjustments that are required due to significant and unforeseen economic and financial events. So in the presentation of the MTBPS done by the DG and the minister the day after tabling the budget, they spoke a lot about the deterioration of economic growth and the deterioration of tax revenue. Therefore, we had to look at the possibility of reducing budgets in the in-year. And basically what we looked at, honorable members and Chairperson, is the underspending or programs that are underspending. We also issued guidelines in August where basically we proposed that departments should restrict non-core recruitment. The DPSA has also issued a directive in that regard. We also had to propose that departments then reduce significantly traveling costs, conferences, workshops, and catering for meetings. We also propose that most of the meetings, especially government meetings, be in the government buildings. We also propose that departments look at the possibility of postponing some of their capital projects, especially those projects where procurement has been an issue and there's a potential underspending, and we're looking at buildings and other fixed structures, but also looking at machinery and other equipment, especially extending the lifespan of, for example, computers from the 3 to 5 years to 5 to 8 years, depending on the quality and the functioning of some of these equipment. We also looked at the surpluses that existed in other public entities, so entities that had surpluses in 2022-23, and the surpluses were approved. Those entities, the transfers were reduced, and we also looked at what we call provisionally allocated. So that was money that was provisionally allocated in the different departments, but hasn't been used. One example of that, of course, honorable members, would be SASA. there was a provisional allocation that was allocated to them of 500 million, but looking at their performance to date and looking at their surpluses that they want to retain, they have sufficient amount to do the payments for the grant. There was no need for proposed allocation. So that 500 million also form part of what we looked at when we came up with these proposals. So in total, the adjustments that we had to do or the reductions that we had to do amounted to 21 billion, where the departments that carried a larger load was the National Treasury, where a reduction of a billion has been proposed for your consideration. Basic education, a proposal of close to 2 billion is proposed. Higher education and training, a proposal of close to... Yes, Chair?
Good morning.
Good morning, Chairperson.
The slide is not moving on my side. I don't know whether it liberates from my side.
Can you see the table, Chair, with the arrows?
No, I'm still on the first slide. I don't know how that works. What's my problem, colleagues? I don't remember.
It's not moving, Chair. It's still on the first slide.
Yeah. Can you please try it and deal with that? Thank you.
Okay, let me unshare it. Let me just change it and then reshare.
Well, start from the, yeah.
Okay, so I think it's a little pants.
Yeah.
Let's see if it works.
Yeah, born and you're a humble. I'm trying not to humble with my sanity.
And then you have a chairperson. Share screen. Okay, let's try it again. Okay, is it now better?
Yeah, but just increase it, you can't see.
Yes. So, sorry, Chair. So this is the slide I was referring to when I was saying the departments that contributed more to this reduction was the National Treasury, the Department of Basic Education of about 2 billion, higher education and training of 3 billion. This is another example where the NSFAS had a surplus of 6.2 billion that they applied for. So that allocation was given to them, that surplus. So this reduction was way offset by the surplus that was allocated to them. And then the Department of Health is another 1.6 billion. And then social development is proposed to contribute 2.1 billion. And this 2.1 billion, honorable members and chairperson, doesn't mean that there will be less people getting the grant. It just basically means that, one, the expected numbers of recipients for all three grants, SRD grant, child support grant, and old age grant, the number of recipients that we estimated at the time is higher than what we're seeing in the numbers. So this doesn't affect the people who qualify, who are eligible to receive the grant. So that's where we're finding these savings. And then we also, I'm on the next slide, Chairperson, I hope you can see it. And another department that is contributing, and this is mainly through conditional grants, would be human settlement as well as transport. So what we tried to do, honorable members, was to avoid an across-the-board reduction because the implications of just looking at across-the-board has a severe impact on service delivery. So we went through working with the department to look at the goods and services, the traveling, looking at what is their core business, and those goods and services that were targeted won't impact on the service delivery. So, for example, if you look at police, their core function is to travel. So you can't really reduce their budget for traveling because you will be impacting on
on their service delivery. But of course, the one that we worry about, and Chairperson and all other board members, would be just the delays in procurement for capital or infrastructure, because that would be where, you know, you expect departments to move in order to deal with some of the service delivery that are required. But because procurement issues persist, and we have seen a clear case of understanding in some of these grants, the implication was that, or the decision was that, let's propose a reduction in this, so that at least we partially offset the impact of the unforeseeable economic and financial event. But we had to look at, as I said, different departments and how this implicates their ability to deliver services. So when there was also a wage bill, a 2023 wage bill agreement, and for the departments that are personnel heavy, it seemed appropriate that additional allocation be granted to these departments. And we looked at both national and provinces. So from the national government, the departments that will be severely impacted by the wage agreement, if not assisted, would be correctional services. And we're proposing that the committee considers adjusting their budget upwards by 800 million, the defense force an upward adjustment of 1.2 billion, and police at a national level an adjustment of 4 billion upwards to deal with the compensation and pressure that have resulted from 2023 wage agreement. And from a provision level, we're proposing that the committee considers an additional allocation of 10.7 billion for provincial health department, as well as 6.8 billion to the provincial. So the provincial education is 10.7, and then provincial health is 6.8 billion. Honorable members, this does not fully compensate for the increases, but with the cost containment guidelines that we're implementing and allowing departments to identify savings and via the money into compensation, we think they can fully they can attempt to fully deal with the wage pressure. One department that has shown a lot of effort in identifying these funds would be correctional services and other departments such as Home Affairs. There were a couple of vironments that we processed throughout the couple of months to try and deal with the wage pressure. But we, in essence, the proposal for your consideration, Chairperson and honorable members, is an addition of 23.5 billion. And this is to deal with the 2023 wage agreement for these personnel heavy departments. Then, honorable members, we also looked at unforeseen and unavoidable expenditure, and mostly here is looking at the disaster funding. So there's a proposal of 1.6 billion that is proposed to deal with the disasters in the provinces that are impacted by these disasters. And another proposal here would be for DECO, and basically this is to deal with the funding for the foreign exchange fluctuations. While the DECO is not the only department that is affected by exchange rate depreciation, but the magnitude of the impact for DECO is very severe, because there are so many, some of their members are in these international or are placed internationally, and an exchange rate impacts, of course, on their living standards. Therefore, the impact was quite severe. Then the proposal here is to compensate DECO for 191 million. Then, Chairperson and honorable members, there was one of the provisional allocations was to the South African Revenue Services. And the reason why it was provisional was because SARS had to submit some of the strategic thinking and documents around how they're going to spend the 1 billion. And also we were expecting them, well, we were looking for a report back on how they spent the previous allocation. So that's why in the budget time, this amount wasn't allocated. It was provisional. Following receipt of those documentation and assessment that we did, then the 1 billion is then allocated to SARS for basically improving the revenue rising capacity. We also had departments that have applied for the rollovers, Chairperson and Honorable Members. And one of those was Home Affairs, where basically the 300 million that was allocated last year couldn't be allocated on time because the bill was passed quite late in the year, in close to the financial year end. Therefore, this amount wasn't, or the Department of Home Affairs wasn't able to transfer this amount to the IEC. So we're proposing that a rollover be granted so that this amount can be transferred to the IEC. And this is for the political party funds. Sorry, Chair, I'm in town, so there's always activity. And the second one would be the basic education. So basically, we're proposing that 235 be rolled over for the accelerated school infrastructure delivery program and other grants such as the infrastructure backlog grant. And then the last one is the rollover by the Department of Employment and Labor, and this is about 4 million, and this is for them to continue to refurbish the existing buildings. There's also items, Chairperson and Honorable Members, that we called self-financing. So basically, this is when a department renders a service and they get paid by external parties, and that money comes into the NRF, and then they have to apply for it so that money can be released back to them. And the biggest ones that we're looking at would be Home Affairs, and this is mainly for the production of the IDs, passports that they do. And then the second one will be the Defence Force, the largest ones, of course, and this is mainly for the reinvestment from the United Nations. So the others, of course, will be GCIS, but those are quite small. But usually we encourage departments to generate their own revenues, and because some of them do generate their own revenues, then we propose that this money be given back to the department so that they can either finish off of some of their once-off spending items such as ITC. So it's always encouraged that departments think outside of the box so that they can also generate their own revenue. And we wouldn't want to punish them that they generate their own revenue, but it goes back to the fiscus and they don't receive it. So we usually propose that Parliament please consider giving them back the money so that they can use it for other pressing spending items that they may have. And then there's just two other ones where it's declared unspent funds. So basically here, we're looking at the local government equitable share, but this was not allocated. It was under the reserve because we had to consider the implications of the electricity cost given the NERSA approval of the increase. So this 1.3 billion was basically reserved for that. But because the costs are lower than what was projected, this 1.3 was then taken back into the system. But you also have for the National Treasury 500 million, and also for the forestry, fisheries and environment another 100 million. So all in all, Chairperson, we're looking at the declared and spent funds of 1.9 billion, close to 2 billion. And we also have to make an estimate in the MPBPS of declared underspending or projected underspending. But because of the reduction in the in-year, what I spoke about earlier, the 21 billion, we don't think that there will be significant underspending. That's why if you look at the line that is referred to as national government projected underspending, it's only around 800 million, because we think because of these reductions, the underspending will be lesser. It's important to note, Chair, that the 21 billion of the proposed reduction is still less than the underspending of last year and the previous years. Last year, the underspending is estimated to be around 28 billion. So the 21, we think, can be achieved without significantly impacting on service delivery. Quickly, Chair, just the final numbers that I want to take you through would be the environments and the shifts. Of course, here, this is just to clarify the environments that the accounting officer may approve, and the environments that must be approved by the National Treasury, and the environments that Parliament will have to approve. So these environments are put in the Adjustment Appropriation Bill, so that when the committee goes through those, they are very clearly stated that these are environments that were approved by Treasury, and these are environments that require Parliament approval. I know this table is small and it tries to summarize the environments, but the messaging here, Chairperson and Honourable Members, is that there's a lot of environments that were done for compensation of employees, about 1.9 billion, and this was to assist a number of departments to cope within with the 2023 wage agreement, especially for those that no allocation was made to them. So we made sure that at least they move money from other spending items to deal with this pressure. There's also some of the environments that were to goods and services transfers. We also see a net environment environment of about 4.5 billion, but also for capital. So this is just the summary, Chairperson, of these environments, but the specific details are then accessible in the schedule, in the bill itself. Thank you, Chairperson. Ravesh, you next.
Thank you, Dr. Medife. Good morning, Honourable Chair, Honourable Members. Ravesh, I'm going to present on the Eskom Debt Relief Amendment Bill. Let me try and project. I know sometimes I do get kicked out, but let me just give it a go. Just checking whether you can see that, Honourable Chair, Honourable Members. All right. Let me start. Let me just.
We can see it, Ravesh. Good morning.
Good morning. Good morning, Honourable Chair. Let me just switch off my camera to save some bandwidth. Thank you, Honourable Chair, Honourable Members, again. So basically, the presentation that we are presenting is dealing with the rationale for the Eskom Debt Relief Amendment Bill. As the Honourable Members would recall, we introduced the Eskom Debt Relief Bill, which was then enacted and then promulgated on the 7th of July. So basically, the amendment bill deals with the fact that Treasury is introducing interest on the Eskom debt relief package, which was announced by the minister earlier this year. And this is to better reflect the cost of this arrangement, with the interest charged will be market related. I think in terms of charging or developing the interest to be charged, we were just cognizant of the fact that we need to just have a delicate balance between the interest that will be charged and the fact that it does not negatively impact Eskom's cash flows, while at the same time we need to ensure that it's a market-related rate. So as I said, in my initial remarks, is that the approach is different for what we envisaged in the Eskom Debt Relief Act when it was then announced through the explanatory notes that the debt relief will be interest-free at that point. So how the interest will be paid and charged is basically the interest will be then dispersed on the amounts, even if Eskom complies to the conditions. So basically, it will attract interest for the dispersed amounts. And what's also important to note that if in the event that Eskom does not meet the conditions, which I will discuss in the future slides, is that then the interest charge will be higher when they fail to comply with the conditions. Now, the subordinated nature of the loan will remain the same. However, it will be interest-bearing loan. I just want to touch on what we mean by subordinated. So basically, in the very unlikely event that Eskom is not in a position to repay debt or defaults, then basically it will then be allowed to repay all other debt, domestic and then foreign, and then this loan will then fall down the chain in terms of repayment. So that's the subordinated nature of the loan and what we mean by that. And then importantly as well to the honorable to the honorable chair and members is that National Treasury has engaged and agreed with Eskom on the approach. So it wasn't unilaterally decided. We made sure that the approach that we're taking from a treasury perspective has been agreed upon, and then subsequently agreed with Eskom, and we're in the process of at the moment finalizing an implementation agreement to effect the fact that we'll be charging interest. Then the chair and honorable members, just the key features of the Eskom debt relief amendment bill. Basically, as I mentioned, we are going to then effect the payment of interest on the disbursed amounts. And then the other part of the debt relief amendment bill deals with the fact that the minister will then have the power to reduce any amounts for the requirements for Eskom in the event of non-compliance with conditions. So, for example, if we have one of the conditions not being met, then the minister may reduce future amounts, be it in this fiscal year or over the next two fiscal years. So basically the bill then proposes, and now we're going into the two sections where we've amended or inserted the two subsections, where basically subsection 2A then reflects that Eskom must pay interest on the amount advanced as a loan in terms of paragraph A, and as we said, at the rate determined by the minister. And then lastly, the second insertion or addition to the Eskom debt relief amendment bill is that if Eskom fails to comply with the conditions, as we said, then the minister may, and I think importantly, after consultation with Eskom, then reduce amounts envisaged in subsection 1. So again, here, what's important is that the amounts that will be reduced only applies to the future amounts not yet advanced to Eskom. So, as we have mentioned, there's been an amount of 36 billion that's been dispersed of the 78 billion support package in this in this financial year. So in the unlikely event that Eskom does not meet a condition, it fails to meet it in the next quarter, then the minister may then reduce the amount. And I think, also important to point out is that the amount that we're looking at reducing, or the maximum amount, is the fact that it may not may not exceed 5% of the total amount for a applicable financial year. So basically 5% for 78 billion for this year, and then 5% for the next 2 years. So basically the amounts that that the minister can reduce the disbursements by may not exceed a maximum of 5% of for this year, 78 billion. And then we've also included the fact that we have to report to the parliamentary committees quarterly in terms of the compliance, and also the fact whether they've not met conditions, and also on the two insertions are in the debt relief bill. Then moving along quickly to the next two slides, Honourable Chair, Honourable Members, this is where we then table the conditions, and they are basically the same, literally the same conditions that were tabled earlier on when we tabled the Eskom Debt Relief Act. I think just a key to point out here is we basically, have tweaked a few of them and added, I think, one or two conditions. But a key to point out is that, we still maintain the existing conditions. But the key ones that I want to point out at this slide is that they may not that they may not borrow without written approval from the Minister of Finance. So basically, they are at the moment, you know, Eskom is not allowed to go to the lenders and borrow, but should they need to borrow, then this will then need written approval from the Minister of Finance. And as we've highlighted before, is that the Eskom guarantee framework agreement of 350 billion rand will then reduce as the relevant redemptions fall due. And important to point out is that the debt relief package does not necessarily mean that we're setting all guaranteed debt. It's a mixture of guaranteed and unguaranteed debt. So you will see that 350 billion will reduce over time as we proceed with the disbursements of the debt relief package. And then on this slide, we basically talk about the issue around, I think the other two issues that, or the two conditions which we've included, is just around the fact that any transactions that are undertaken in terms of Section 54 of the PFMA, the Public Finance Management Act, must also be then subject to joint approval by the Minister of Public Enterprises and the Minister of Finance. And this Section 54 deals with major transactions in terms of Eskom's significance and materiality framework, where it deals with acquisitions, disposals, or joint ventures. And here we basically included this condition around the fact that these approvals now will be jointly undertaken by the Minister of Finance and by the Minister of Public Enterprises. And I was going to go back to the previous slide where we also talk around the fact that we also mentioned that there is also the condition around the unbundling. In fact, it's in the next one, where we basically say that Eskom, this is bullet point two, where Eskom must continue to prioritize and expedite the implementation of the unbundling process and also ensure that they obtain the lender consent to fully implement unbundling. So these conditions, Honorable Chair and Honorable Members, have been formally shared with Eskom, and now we are also then formally sharing it with this parliamentary committee. And then on my last slide, basically, we just talk about how we'll be executing the monitoring of the compliance of the conditions. So we've established a monitoring task team, which convenes quarterly, we'll monitor compliance to the conditions. In fact, we received the first report a few days ago. And basically, how the monitoring will be executed is that if Eskom complies to the conditions, then the loan, as we've outlined, the disbursements will be advanced as a loan on which interest will be charged. Then that loan will be then for that quarter will be converted into equity. I think it's important for the honourable member and honourable chair to note that it's important for the loan to be converted to equity to ensure that Eskom remains a going concern. And importantly, the next point just talks about failure to comply to the conditions will mean that Eskom will then not have the equity or the loan converted into equity until the next quarterly meeting. So they have an opportunity for the next quarter to ensure that conditions are met. And then if they meet the conditions in the next quarter, so we're giving them a grace period of another quarter, and where compliance is met, then they will be converted into equity. However, if we have a worst case scenario where Eskom just generally fails to meet the conditions consistently, this will result in the loan being carried over until 31st of March 2026, where the loan will then be converted into a liability payable in cash and at market terms. So, Honourable Chair and Honourable Members, I know this is quite technical, but I think it's important to just highlight exactly how monitoring will be done and how the conversion will be done. And then we also point out the fact that if required post 2026, where they have not met the conditions, then we will then enter into a separate loan agreement to set the terms and conditions related to the interest-bearing loan. And then Eskom will be required to pay the outstanding loan within the year. So, Honourable Chair and Honourable Members, I think here it's quite important to outline the fact that it remains in Eskom's best interest to ensure that they meet the conditions, to ensure that the loan is converted into equity, to ensure that they remain a going concern, And failure to consistently meet the conditions will mean that they will then need to repay this loan at the, in 2026, 2027, which is not in the best interest of ESCOM, and it then means that they will be negatively impacted in terms of their finances. The last point that we want to point out is that, with these conditions, it's therefore important that they do meet these conditions, as I've highlighted, and it's also important for ESCOM to ensure that they rigorously and robustly meet these or submit the report, quarterly report, meet the conditions, because as we've highlighted in the first slide, is that if conditions are not met, you firstly will be, then ESCOM will be charged a higher interest rate or a penalty interest rate. And then on top of that, the minister may then also reduce future amounts from the debt relief arrangement. So I think ESCOM is well aware of the implications of not meeting these conditions. We've shared the outline of how this will be executed, and they are in agreement. And so I think it remains in ESCOM's best interest to ensure that they meet the conditions. And again, here, we don't want to see a position where ESCOM is in a default position where they don't meet the conditions and cannot convert the loan into equity. So hence the rigorous monitoring from our side on a quarterly basis, but even between the quarters as well, Honorable Chair and Honorable Members, we are engaging with ESCOM to ensure that they are in compliance with this loan. And as we correctly pointed out at the beginning of the presentation, is that this loan is going to be treated as a market-orientated transaction, and it's also different from the past recapitalizations that we provided to SOCs. So this basically then concludes the presentation from my side, Honorable Chair and Honorable Members. I then hand over to you, Honorable Chair and Honorable Members. Thank you.
Thank you, Ravesh. thank you, Mary Jane and the team, Mampo and the team, and Ravesh and all people who made the presentation. Honourable members, three bills have been presented to you by National Treasury. Then you may engage with the presentations. You know how we do it. Can I have indications of our members would like to have a go on the presentations? I'm listening, our members. It's going to break the ice. Our members, you mean it was so clear there are no takers today?
Everything.
Okay, Honorable Menezi, right. Next.
Chairperson, I think indeed to agree.
Honorable Menezi, just hold. I just want to check again who also want to have, to say something. Just hold, Honorable Menezi. Who's number two? I've got Honorable Menezi number two. Okay, the kind of, I see somebody saying that it's struggling to connect. I'm recognizing you.
Thank you very much, Chairperson. I'm not very sure of the area I'm in. Should I still keep my video off?
No, please show the video. We'll see if you have. I did want to see a video. This is. Yeah.
Yes, Chairperson. I think I'm now can be seen.
Please, no, switch off the video. Switch off the video.
With light. Thank you. Thank you, Chairperson.
Yeah.
Thank you, Chairperson.
Yeah.
Chairperson, I think I agree with the presentation and the wish to welcome. I think the presenters were very clear. they were giving reasons for what they were presenting, which is always important that we must know the reason behind the changes. So I think with that clarity, then it leaves less room for us to question. But there's one point, Chair, that always worries me, and I know it worries all of us, the failure to spend the allocated budget by various departments and provinces as well. So it's something that one would want the National Treasury to have a way of working towards eliminating. We're working with professionals, people who understand when they present their own budget and targets, they understand the meaning. So we have people who must also ensure, in terms of seniority, that indeed the budget are spent, the targets are met, because we are here to serve the community. Failure to spend is compromising the community out there. So I think that's the worry, that's the clarity the National Treasury should really explain. How are we allowing the lack of spending the requested budget on behalf of our communities is continuing? I think that would be my worry, and I would want explanation. Why do we allow people to commit murder? Because it's murder not to spend the budget, because the budget doesn't belong to department. It belongs to the communities out there, and I know they need it. Thank you, Chairperson.
Thank you, Honorable Memezi. Honorable Kaiso. Honorable Kaiso, I see your hand. Okay. Honorable Kaiso.
Can you get me?
Yes, just continue, let's see. We are faint, but let's try.
Yeah, now let me also take this opportunity to welcome that presentation by the department. In fact, it has impacted all the corners of the budget, as well as being informed by the NCDPF policy that has been made recently. So I don't think one expect much more new, other than that obviously talking to that, and so one would like to welcome that. But I also quickly want to go to what Honorable Member said.
Just hold. Check with Team Treasurer. Can you follow Honorable Kaiso, Madam Jane?
Honorable Chair, I'm not able to hear him properly.
Yeah. Mampo?
I'm also struggling, Chairperson.
Honorable,
I'm also struggling.
Okay. Honorable Kaiso, definitely we are struggling. So, and then they won't be able to give you the answers that you are looking for. We are really, really struggling to. Can you please try another spot if you can? Otherwise, just write to us, even if you're, write to me. I'll pose the questions on your behalf, because we definitely can't hear you.
Try another.
Okay, thanks. Any other honourable member would like to say something? Let me come in with my questions. Okay, Honourable Kaiso. Thank you. Thank you very much, Tim Sejari, for the presentations. And I think we the biggest reason for the intervention, whether it's the Division of Revenue amendment or amendment appropriations, mainly because of the economic conditions that the country finds itself in, that we didn't have enough revenue as it was projected at the beginning of the year. So we I think that's the reason. And our understanding will be these are temporary interventions. I can see that we projected the cuts over the MTF period. for me, doing that, it's more like accepting that things are not going to change, especially that the economy is not growing. So I've raised this before, and I think that's what should also be occupying yourselves and government in general and South Africans, is that our intervention is not sustainable. It can't be something that we're saying we are going to follow with these cuts and so on. And we know that the fact that we didn't get enough revenue, it's a function of the economy, which is not growing at the rate that is required, so that you can have all these taxes increasing and therefore start collecting enough. So I think what we need to spend more time in saying, what role do we play to make sure that the economy starts going at a higher rate? Because the situation that we're in is definitely not sustainable. And I don't see us for the next 3 years cutting expenditures like what we're doing, because the implications are dire. So that's what I would like to say. That's the message that we got again, as you heard from PPO and from the FFC yesterday. So I always get the impression that as government, we are not spending enough time on dealing with growth. How do we get growth back to the economy? I'm not going to point at any particular area, but I asked the question one day, Madi Jing, that our interventions at local government level are very important, because all said and done, if I must establish a business somewhere, it must be the local government. So to look at those areas which attract investors to go and locate somewhere. And simple things like the green term, the provision of services, the collection of refuse. Those things may seem very peripheral, but people look at those things. When I come to a town and say, I get the impression that if refuse has not been collected, to say, how can I come and risk R1 billion in a town which can't collect refuse before you come to the provision of water and before you come to the provision of electricity? So part of course from my side is that let's look at for instance, the ERP, I was paying close attention to that to make sure that we do get the growth that we are trying to get. So for me, that's very important. And then pose the question to National Treasurer that members of Parliament, FFC, PBO, the members of the public, they only come and make presentations as to how they think that things should be done. I just want to get an honest opinion. Do you consider those things, or once you put your thinking into a particular way of doing things, that's it, right? And it'd be nice to get some examples of the areas where you have considered what all these role players are saying, so that they get encouraged that you continue making some inputs into our way of doing things. On this one, I think you said we understand the immediate external shocks that we got and so on, and put our revenues in this situation, right? but you would agree with me that the cuts that were heavy, whatever reason, valid reasons for things like underspending, but they are not helping us to grow the economy. So those would be my broad inputs. But let me come to particular questions. There are rollovers in the school infrastructure. I think it's KZN, Limpopo, in Eastern Cape, and that's not the first time. So exactly, it has been these types of rollovers. Money being transferred from one province, especially these provinces. What interventions have we made, right? As national treasury, as provinces, and to try and avoid this. That's my first question. Yeah, I also wanted to. There's a net on national grants, right? You've got a net reduction of 6.6. Billion rand, that is provinces and at local government level, that's 5.9 billion rand. That's a lot of money. Can you please just remember that as you make these presentations, you're not just talking to us here, the public is out there listening. One, exactly to say, what were these conditional grants intended for? Two, because this is over MTF, right? So two, just to share with the public, what types of interventions that we're making to try as government. Remember, I always say this, that people out there, they're not very much concerned about national, provincial or local government. It's government to try and resolve this. I'm sure this is also related to Honorable Menezes' question. Next question, can you confirm that yesterday we had the indebtedness of the municipalities is 100 billion rand? I was not sure whether that talks to the people we owe money because they provided service and so on, or it's because of the debt that we have gone out and raised. So I my interest was more on the debt that has been raised. How much is that? And what is the debt service cost that is being paid? Have they been able to live to the terms or conditions of that debt? Are there any redemptions which are due also at local government level? That was my third question. I think this goes to Rajiv on when you're talking about the conditions and so on. I didn't understand exactly what you are saying. If you go to a slide which has got BB2, I didn't understand that. You will do a slide. I just wrote it down like that. And then, as you speak about procurement issues persist as a reason for underspending. What does that mean, procurement issues persist? What issues are those? And obviously, what are we doing with that? Because we get this, now we're in our term, you get this thing of underspending. One of the reasons being this, what exactly does that mean? There's a change to the payment of financial assets, I think a reduction of about 502 million rand. What has happened today? Why all of a sudden having money that you can take away from the national treasury? On the debt relief of ESCOM, there's an interest that the amendment that we're dealing with is about interest charge. I just want to check what has changed between July and now that you've all of a sudden decided that you need to have an interest there. And aren't you creating onerous conditions which will make it difficult for ESCOM to meet your debt? I'm saying here you are moving the goalposts out. Imagine if I go and we agree on something and while I'm still busy that you come in again and introduce. I'm just worried whether Eskom in the first place will be able to deal with this thing. But again, to put on a more onerous condition, I'm afraid of a situation where because they can't meet these conditions, you find them going to NERSA, wanting that the tariff be increased, finally being passed to the consumers. Do you think that's prudent? I'm definitely not sure about that. Please talk to it. Then talking about Eskom, obviously one of the conditions is the question of unbundling and so on. Can I check with you, do we have financial projections of the end state of Eskom? What does this mean, the unbundling and so on? How is going to help us as for instance, as Parliament? So the question, any financial projections and modeling that you have had of the end state of an unbundled Eskom? And lastly, you see, whenever we go out and talk about SOEs and the money that government and parliament give to the SOEs, people these days are asking, are saying, but you are putting all these billions of friends into the SOEs, in particular Eskom, and Transnet. So much instability at high level, and you know that these companies are very difficult to understand. They've got real challenges and so on. Are we having a strategy to deal with this movement, this instability at that level? Those would be my questions. Let me check oral members. Anybody else would like to come after me? I think let me allow the team to respond to the question. Thank you.
Thank you, Chairperson. I will start and then I'm getting Memory Jing Sim to deal with some of the intergovernmental ones and the rest to do with SOCs. So, Chairperson, I mean, the first thing, the first question on understanding. There's different reasons why department understands, and there are good reasons for the understanding. Sometimes there are bad reasons for understanding. So good reasons would be if the department has implemented cost-saving measures or they've improved efficiencies. When I did the presentation, there was a part or a slide that talked about self-financing. Some of those self-financing proposals are because of the improvements that have been implemented by departments. However, there are other elements of understanding that are problematic. And the first reason that we get to deal with is basically the capacity of the state. There are areas where the departments find it difficult to do procurement or to follow the PFMA in terms of how to spend. There's also issues of non-adherence to conditions. For example, the municipalities have to adhere to conditions in the Division of Revenue Bill. If they don't adhere to those conditions, then the transfers get withheld. So that's another reason for understanding, but you also get understanding where the verification processes take too long for other departments. That's mostly what results in the rollover process. So you have departments where they have been verifying invoices between themselves and the suppliers, and that process take too long. Honourable members and Chairperson, I mean, it's no secret that to procure goods and services in government takes too long. The supply chain processes are slow, and at the end, the departments then tend to postpone some of these spending that they were planning to do because of procurement processes or procurement hurdles that take too long. The procurement bill is supposed to assist with some of those, not all of them, with some of the hurdles that are there. But procurement in the state remains a hindrance in getting services or within services to be procured. So I mean the understanding due to efficiencies, as I said, is what we look for and that's what we encourage. The adherence to some of these conditions, we do work with departments and local governments to help them adhere to these. So you find that in December or whichever quarter, there's X number of municipalities that are not adhering to this, but you find that in the following quarter that has been resolved. So we do work with departments and intergovernmental or provinces and local government to try and assist them. But unfortunately, the element of understanding will be persistent in the state. What can also assist, especially in infrastructure projects, is to make sure that the departments have their plans ready much earlier in the year, so that when they start the procurement process, they don't start it later in the year, but they start it in the beginning of the year. That will lessen the stress of procurement. But mainly, if you don't have, if you're still finalizing the plan, and you start your procurement in the second half of the year, the likelihood of underspending is higher. Chairperson, we agree with the analysis that you've made in terms of the MTF budget reduction. You stated very clearly that the problem that we have is not a spending problem. So we don't have a spending problem in the state where we can't manage government spending. The problem that we have is a growth problem, and in an absence of economic growth, rising debt, less revenue, spending becomes one of those elements that government has to reconsider. So because we have a growth and revenue problem, then unfortunately spending has to be considered. But I agree with you that the manner in which we do the spending reductions, if we have to do them, has to be very strategic. It shouldn't be an across-the-board reductions where we, you know, the proposal is a 10% cut across the board or something like that. I think right now what would be critical to preserve service delivery is, one, to grow the economy and focus on the reforms that need to be implemented. If we do have to go the budget reduction route, those reductions have to be strategic and they must be program-based rather than across the board, because when you do a program-based approach, then at least you give departments time to rethink the program, the implementation of the program, while you pause it for a couple of years until such time that the department come up with a better way to implement some of those programs. So we basically looking at cost containment measures that we have implemented that should continue. Secondly, we will be looking at the surpluses of public entities and encouraging those public entities to start utilizing the surpluses to mute the impact. And then thirdly, of course, looking at the different programs and the spending reviews that we have done be what we use as a starting point, because a lot of work has been done in assessing the efficiencies of some of the programs that are in the system. So that work should be what is used to base the decision on which programs need to be reconsidered. And I think once we do that, Chairperson, we will mute the impact on service delivery. But of course, the conversation of the budget reductions is always so difficult. Chairperson, in your third comment about public consultation, once you finalize your report, we do consider the proposals there and we report in the budget review of how we have considered the recommendations by the committee. And what we also do is that when we go through the budget process itself and present in cabinet the budget proposals, the recommendations will be part of the conversations that we have. But also there are meetings with different stakeholders before tabling of the budget and the MTBPS. And we also have the NEDLAC processes where we do the presentations there. This year, the president also invited NEDLAC to have a broader discussion on the economic growth and the fiscal framework. So these conversations, Chairperson, and the contributions that the public has are considered through those interactions. Examples would be, I mean, as much as they are not exactly how the stakeholders requested them or presented them, but you can look at the conversation on the SRD grant and the continuation of the presidential employment intervention. So most of those, of course, do get considered, but of course, the budget is, you have to look at everything else. So some of the proposals that are there, unfortunately, may not be funded now, or may not be possible to fund now, but later on, then consideration is then made. In terms of the final one, Chairperson, for me would be the financial assets, the payment for financial assets. So what happened was the lenders of the land bank wrote a letter to the Treasury requesting payment because the land bank has defaulted. That transaction, Chairperson, was recorded as a direct charge from the National Revenue Fund. So that payment was made, but Treasury was allocated the 1 billion for the land bank. Therefore, because the money was already paid through the NRF, it meant that the budget for the land bank will then be reduced by the 500 million because that's what we ended up paying. I think it was the World Bank and another lender. So this is just, it doesn't mean they didn't spend it, but it's mainly because it's a transaction recording process where money was allocated through the direct charge, but money was already allocated for the Treasury. So just fixing that just means that the Treasury budget would be reduced by the 500 odd million. Thanks, Chairperson. Member Dijeng?
Thank you, Chairperson. You know, this problem, Honorable Memezi, of failure of the organs of state to spend, it is a problem that is a big issue for us also, and is a big concern. And it's even more concerning for us because we are always, as Treasury, the ones that seems to be held accountable for the failure of the organs of state to perform. And I expected to do something about it simply because we are allocating the money, which I'm not sure whether that also would help us to move forward, because I doubt if we do have capacity as just National Treasury to make provinces, local governments, departments that come to us and say we have got needs and this is how we are going to spend the money and we need the money. And we allocate, the allocations are made on the basis of that understanding. So now, when they don't perform, the issue for me is, how are they being held accountable for their performance rather than us being held accountable for their failure to perform? Of course, we do a lot to try to help. We do it. We run programs for municipalities. We are doing a number of things that are trying to assist. But I do think that there is also a need to lift up the way they are being held accountable. Because what we are seeing is that even allocating money doesn't help government to also stimulate growth. Because what we are seeing with CAPEX is that it actually has a negative multiplier, which means the money that we allocate is not really bringing about the kind of investments that we are looking for, in addition to that money not being spent. So because what we are seeing even in the grants that we are in the current year, what has been reduced is less than what actually has been underspent largely by the organs of state. So you can see that maybe even in the forward years, those cuts are probably aligning with the capacity of the state to spend. So I think the greatest problem that we are all concerned about is really around how do we lift up the capacity of the state to spend and to spend efficiently, right? So that then we are getting much greater value for money that we have. And I still believe that if efficiency can be lifted up, the money that is there in the system can deliver way more than the cuts that have been reduced by. So I think for me, the cry for me is we need help also as Treasury to ensure that there is a big push to ensure that the organs of state are performing, because that is what the country needs for us to be able to do so. So with regard to the municipalities, I will allow Jan also to maybe have some comments on some of the specific questions that Honorable Chair you have asked on municipalities. Jan, are you on the line?
I am, Chairperson. Good morning, Honorable Chair. Am I visible?
Yes, Jan.
Thanks. So, Chairperson, we fully agree with your point that you've made, Honorable Chair, that in order for the private sector to consider to invest in a municipality, that the environment should be conducive. The city should be clean. The municipality should come across as if they on top of their management issues. So, Chair, that is an area of work that needs a lot more attention from both the municipalities, but also from where we sit as the oversight institutions. That's the first issue. Chair, when you have asked about the amount that was quoted in the committee yesterday, so the 100 billion rand, Chairperson, that was referred to was the total outstanding creditors as at the 31st as at the end of June 2023. So that means the municipality has rendered services, or they've asked somebody to do services for them, and the amount to be paid is outstanding. And in terms of the Municipal Finance Management Act, the date in which you are supposed to pay your invoices is within 30 days. So, Chair, that amount is 99.9 billion, or the 100 billion that you referred to. Included, Chair, in that amount is the two biggest creditors, which is when Eskom and the water boards. And, Chair, if you look at our fourth quarter Section 71 publication, you would see at that point the Eskom amount was 49.2 billion and the water boards was 16.3 billion. So, Chair, that's largely the 100 billion that you've referred to, Honorable Chair. In addition, the second question, Chair, that you've asked on the stock of debt, Chair, we do publish a quarterly, in addition to the Section 71 publication, a bulletin on municipal borrowing. And, Chair, the debt stock at that point in time towards the end of the previous financial year that ended 30 June, the amount was 70.5 billion rand. So, Chair, that amount is largely in the metro space, and we do have the information, Chair, that we can perhaps share with a committee. I hope that is it, Chairperson.
Yeah, sorry to interrupt you. I didn't get the debt stock that is there. Is it how much?
The debt stock as at the end of June, Honorable Chair, is 70.5 billion rand. And the largest component of that is in the metro space. And Chair, we have a bulletin that we publish quarterly, and we can certainly share that with the Secretariat, Chair, to give the information through to the committee. Thanks, Chair.
Yes, Ravesh can come through.
Thanks, Mayor Mother Jeng. Thanks, Honorable Chair. If I'm not mistaken, you had four questions for us related to state-owned companies. I'm going to take three of them, and I'm going to give the unbundling one to Jeff to deal with. Chair, I think you raised the question around on the slide around BB2, which deals with the 5%, maximum of 5%, if I'm not mistaken. I just want to make sure that I'm on the same page as you around that question that you raised, the first one.
Are you able to flight that piece so that?
Let me just flight it for you quickly. Let me just go back to, here we go. Chair, can you see that?
Yeah.
Okay, this is the one in terms of applies to may not exceed 5% of the financial year.
Great.
Yeah, let me just stop sharing this. So Honorable Chair, in terms of how this would actually work, and we have to apologize because I think, you know, the presentation does go into a bit of the technical details, but I think it's important that we unpack this. So in terms of how the 5% would work, so, you know, as we said, in terms of ESCOM does not meet the conditions, let's say for a quarter, then the minister has may reduce future allocations in the fiscal year, so from future disbursements. So what we mean by that in terms of the 5%, so if one looks at the 78 billion that is that will be dispersed in this fiscal year, of which 36 billion has been dispersed, so in the situation where ESCOM does not meet a condition, then the minister may reduce future allocations to the maximum of 5%. So if you take 5% of 78 billion, that gives you 3.9 billion. So the minister may reduce future allocations in the fiscal year, in this fiscal year, which is 23-24, by a maximum of 3.9 billion. And then if we move into the next fiscal year, a maximum of 2 billion. However, Chair, I think it's important to outline to you and, you know, the honorable members is that we have discussed this with ESCOM. And, you know, obviously we are mindful of the impact that this may have on the financials. So there has been agreement in terms of what this could do for them in terms of negatively, impacting their financials. So they are working very hard to ensure that they meet the conditions so that they don't have a situation where, the minister may then have to invoke the section of the amendment bill. I think a key case in point is we've mentioned this before when we presented to yourselves, and the committee is, for example, the disposal of the ESCOM Finance Company, where we want to see some significant progress in terms of disposal of that non-core assets. Chair, I think related to that is your question on the interest charge. I think it's important to just outline and reemphasize again is that when we presented the bill, or the ESCOM debt relief bill, which is now an act, we did make mention that that this support package to ESCOM will not be a pure recapitalization. It will be then dispersed as a loan. So we're moving away from the traditional forms of recapitalization, as you know, where we disperse or we recapitalize and there is no recourse on Treasury and government and also Parliament in terms of where entities don't meet conditions. So by reflecting or executing this debt relief package in the form of a loan, we then had to ensure that it is market orientated and that it, that it reflects, the correct, understanding of a loan, which in the traditional sense must attract interest. Now, we also discussed this with Eskom to say that there will be interest charged on the loan. So they have also accepted that fact, and obviously they've built that in or baked that in into their financials. So they are in a position to actually meet those interest payments, as well. So I think that's the second question. So we're doing away from the traditional sort of recapitalizations, and we're moving to some, a form of a loan, and there may be other mechanisms that we may look at in terms of should we be placed in a position to provide support. Then we would look at how we can then ensure that the conditions that we place on Eskom and other entities are actually met and not where we have to report to yourself on a quarterly basis where, some of the entities don't meet the conditions. What recourse or what teeth do we have in terms of the conditions that we provide? And then, Chair, I think the other question around what do we do around the instability of SOCs? That's a very difficult one. I think we can spend a long time around it. But just our experience around the instability of SOCs, in terms of the history, in terms of how we've dealt with SOCs, what we found, generally speaking, is that there's a lot of instability in the boards and then in the management that's appointed. And then what we generally tend to find is that when you have a new board, you have a new management, you then have a new turnaround plan, and then with that turnaround plan, you will see there'll be an ask for a recapitalization, which we obviously want to change. And I think the work that's been undertaken by the Presidential State-Owned Enterprises Council in terms of governance around how do we really deal with the governance issues around SOCs from that level, will really create the stability that we need in terms of SOCs from a board level, filtering down into a management level, and then with a turnaround plan that always requires some form of government support. We're also moving away from just relying purely on government support and looking at how do we really get entities to contain costs, sell off non-core assets, a similar approach that we did for the likes of Denel, where we provided support, but that they also need to provide support internally from cost containment stroke, what we call self-help initiatives. So I think that's an important point that we want to raise as well, and also the fact that you also need to look at how you get outside assistance in terms of not privatization, but in terms of private sector to come in and augment support that may be provided by government. And then I'll just hand over to Jeff just to deal with the unbundling question, and I'll hand over back to you, Jeff. Thank you.
Thanks, Ravesh, and good morning, Chair. I see my camera is actually giving me some challenges here, Chair. So with your indulgence, I'll proceed. The first part, Chair, that I just want to touch on is around your question on whether these changes are not introducing onerous, are not going to be onerous on Eskom. We view it differently, Chair, that this will actually introduce an enforced discipline in Eskom to meet the conditions so that at the end of the period, we are able to actually meet our objective of what we're seeking to achieve, which is to ensure that the entity is able to stand alone on its own without the government support. Members would recall that we've been giving Eskom a number of financial support, and at the end of the day, we are not actually yielding the desired results because at times the conditions are not fully met, and those that are being met are not actually moving the needle in terms of turning around the entity. So the conditions that we have introduced this time around are geared such that they are able to actually ensure that the entity it is turning around at the end of the period, and we can ensure that it's able to actually stand on its own 2 feet without any government support,
Hence, we've already taken also the taken over also the guarantees, which were another form of backing that we've been giving to ESCOM. So we view this as a form of actually enforcing discipline so that ESCOM is able to actually meet these conditions on a regular basis, and we are able to turn it around. Coming to the unbundling, Chair, so far there is no detailed modeling that we've been that we've done on all the three entities. And the reason being, at this stage, we're still dealing with the governance arrangement of how the entities are going to look like, getting all the PFMA approvals set out. Also, with the transmission as the priority for now, we've already seen that the entity has already been granted the licensing approvals by the regulators, which are critical in ensuring that the entity is able to actually start operating as a subsidiary. However, on the transmission side, there are projections that have been actually undertaken just to ensure that you give a picture of how the entity would look like. But underlying those is critically the revenues, which at this stage it's still a bundled tariff, and for us to actually do those detailed modeling, we'll actually have to understand from the regulator how the methodology going forward will be undertaken, which will then give us a sight in terms of how we can then do the full unbundling of the financial structures of all these entities. So far, we are actually interacting with the lenders to get their lender consent. But at this stage, because the subsidiaries are going to be under the holdings company, so you would still have the intercompany transaction within the group. Hence, there is no much detailed financial modeling that has been done so far. How this unbundling is going to help us? I think that the biggest benefit of this will be for us to actually get a clear line of sight of what each business is doing and how each business is actually operating. We've recognized in the conditions so far, Honorable Chair and Honorable Members, that transmission is quite critical in ensuring that we are able to address the load shedding by ensuring that there's enough investment that comes through in the transmission space. So by starting to actually ring fence these entities into smaller chunks, we are able to then to actually understand what each business is doing and what intervention will be required, if any, at any given time. So I think by that, Chair, we'll be able to then address the challenges, because at this stage, this is just a too big entity that at times it's difficult to actually weigh unwillingly into the operations of the entire business. I will stop there, Chair, and hand it back to you. Thank you.
Thank you very much for those responses. Honorable Kaiso, you wanted to come in? Honorable Kaiso?
Yes, am I audible now?
Yes, Munyuan.
Okay. Thank you very much for the presentation, which has been made by Treasury and quickly, I don't want to be long, but I just want to start here first on an awkward position. Dr. Mumpo, you gave us a report, a third quarter report. Was it a third quarter report? We're listening so attentively about the development of the whole expenditure, et cetera. But little did we know that we were actually headed towards a crash, as when just after a month we had this big challenge that confronted the budget. That one asked himself, why didn't we, get this hint, as just a warning, as you were giving us a report. It then you know, I'm just raising it. I know we are late by now. We are already in it. But then, let me appreciate the presentation that the Treasury has made. My first question is on what is your take on this issue of which has been raised by Auditor General, the issue of employment of, you know, consultancy and exorbitant fees which have been charging the local municipalities. I don't know what is the take of the Treasury around this. Are you able to reign over this in a way? I know, I understand that other spheres which have been governed by that particular act, but then actually this has had, you know, a bad reflection where you have double spending but with no impact. In as far as, you know, fiscal is concerned, because we have people who are in the public service, but at the same time get extra or double each and every position for an amount for a cost. What is the take of the Treasury? Are you able to rein in over this? Can you please rein in if there should be a way that Treasury also should be able to rein in that matter. And secondly, it's on the issue on the spin-off from SARS. And hopefully that Treasury, that you have tabled this presentation, enough resources have been deployed such that now this department is able to mobilize in tax collection, in order to boost the fiscal standard. So I'm hoping that this will be able to assist. If not so, it should really happen, because there's nothing that, if there's no tax collection or revenue collection, you know, the country will be assisted forward in terms of revenue mobilization. Now, what informed at that time? I know Treasury, the staff had reported a big spin of billions of rand ahead, you know, of the medium term years ahead. So you even made your own projection, but all of a sudden, when things evaporated, we don't know what could have caused that evaporation. That projection just fell off, and nowhere now we see any immediate positive results that are coming. Instead, the declination of revenue, that's what then become an order of the day. So I'm not sure what informed Treasury at that time to say that the projection that we have made by that, you know, will take us further, you know, ahead. Thirdly, it's only the issue of the Transnet. You see, Transnet plays a very key role in as far as economic recovery is concerned. But I know there has been during the policy statement where it has been clearly been made that now there is a plan that Treasury and the Transnet has been working around. So I don't know how far is that, and when is the deadline or timeline to effect that, because of the decline in as far as performance of the state-owned enterprise. And then I think on the issue of understanding, I'm covered by my colleague. Yes. No, thank you very much.
Thank you, Honorable Kaiso. Honorable Nenezi. Do you want to have a second point? No? Okay. Let me come in. No, thank you for the responses. Perhaps my comment will be I am worried about the postponement of some capital projects. As a way when you do this thing, and well, perhaps why I'm worried about it is that
That's again an area where we would have thought that as you build capital projects, yeah, there is an opportunity of crowding in private sector, giving opportunities to small business, et cetera, et cetera. So that's that I would like you to comment on that. Mampo, I don't understand what it means to expand the lifespan of your IT equipment. I'll tell you why. My assumption is that the years that you had was based on some scientific reasons that, well, a cell phone was a computer and so on. Now that we are having this problem, magically a lifespan can be expanded to, let's say, 5 years instead of three. I don't know if they want to comment on that. You see, when it comes to conditional grants, the impact and stuff, I think we understand, but it's like this grant is very problematic. Can you just, for the benefit of people out there, just explain how a conditional grant works and types of problems that we've encountered? I know the grants at one stage to call the mayors and ministers to the committee because of some grants which were not used. But I just say for clarity, just explain so that perhaps you can see and people out there can understand the challenges that we are having with this grant. I've made this point before, Mary Jane, that we raise these things here, firstly because you are the bearer of bad news about some of the things which are happening in the department. But by no means we expect National Treasury to solve those problems. But we do expect you to do something as National Treasury and the Minister. For instance, to elevate those things to cabinet and have a new president. There's a bottleneck here and so on, or that, right? So when we raise some of these things, it's not necessary to say to you, you must solve them yourself. But definitely, it can't just end between us and ourselves. On our side, using our own channels, we also elevate it to Parliament, to the Speaker, and say these are the issues. For instance, this thing of conditional grants is one area that we definitely want to raise it with the Speaker, with Parliament, that it is problematic. So I'll request that you identify mainly those municipalities where these grants have not been raised, and please write back to us. I mean, have not been used. Write back to us so that as the committee also try to to take it with the higher authorities of Parliament. Please come in. The issues we have just raised, please come in and comment on them. Thank you.
Thank you, Chairperson. I will start. These are quite complicated issues you are raising with the committee. So for the first quarter spending, we presented a first quarter number of 8.2 billion, and we submitted the report for the second quarter yesterday to Parliament. Hopefully you have received it, Chair and honorable members. We're looking at an underspending of 9.6 billion. And as in the past, Chairperson, I was going to request that when we come back to brief the committee or responding to the presentations by the different stakeholders, that we also take the second quarter report, so that when you deliberate on the appropriation, did you also take that information into consideration? So, Chairperson, I can reshare the presentation that we did in the first quarter, but I think if time permits in our next appearance in this committee,
to take the committee through the second quarter. At least that will bring more updated information, just so that you have an indication of who's underspending, who's overspending, and why the differences between what is estimated and the actual spending. So, Chairperson,
I was saying perfect. Let's do it that way. When you come back to us, then you can make those.
Thank you so much, Chairperson. And then the issue on the computers and the lifespans and the cars. So, Chairperson, I agree with you that there's a standard 5 years for a laptop or 5 years for a car. But some of these assets, they still work beyond the 5 years that has been predetermined. We are not saying that departments must suffer and use old machines that are not functioning. But if your machine is still functioning, there's nothing wrong with it, there's no harm in using it for the next 6 months, which is 5 years and 6 months or another year, until it gives you a problem, then you can replace it. Even with cars, not for chasing criminal type of cars. We're looking at administrative vehicles. If the Department of Social Development, for example, is doing visits and the car is still functioning after 150,000 kilometers, for example, then there's no harm in the department continuing to use that car up to, let's say, 180,000 kilometers if the car is still functioning. So it's more of looking at the quality of the assets that you have, the functionality of the assets that you have. So it shouldn't hinder you from doing your job. But if it's still functioning, then I think it's something that we are considering. Let me just ask Spencer to give some of the examples in terms of delayed in the procurement because of the replications, especially respond to also the infrastructure grants in education before we go to Ravesh. Spencer?
Hello. Thank you, Mampo. Good morning, honorable members. Thanks, honorable chair, for the chance to just give a response on the question of related to the rollovers for the school infrastructure backlogs grant. So Mampo did provide some information in that regard earlier, but just as a to illustrate the point a little bit more clearly, the infrastructure work in that program continues throughout the year, as you would want and as we expect it to do. And the payment for work delivered happens when invoices for that work that has been completed is received by the department, and then the department has to go out and verify that the work is actually done as stated and to the quality as expected. And work that is then completed in March, it's very difficult to get that even when invoices are received, to get that verification done before books are closed at the end of the year. And it is those projects for which verification has not happened by the time books have to close that then go into the rollover process. So invoices are received in time or are received for work that has been done before the 31st of March. And it is just this verification process. It's often, in the case of this infrastructure backlogs grant, there are many small projects in the provinces the chair mentioned, in particular Eastern Cape, KZN, and Limpopo sometimes, especially around the sanitation projects. And so it's difficult to get that verification process done before the books close. The processes have improved over the past few years considerably, and so this underspending or even applications for rollovers have also gone down as the processes around this verification of work completed has improved. But it is not a reflection in this case so much of slow spending as a result of under-delivery. It is more that the processes for verification in particular have to catch up to the actual delivery, and so that the spending can actually take place. Thanks. Thank you, Jay. Thanks.
Thanks, Spencer, and thanks, Honourable Chair. I think just the question on Transnet, Honourable Chair and Honourable Members. I think in terms of the alignment of the Transnet turnaround plan and the roadmap, I know from the presidency and from the discussions we had, in fact, with the Transnet yesterday, that there is ongoing engagements around ensuring that the turnaround plan is aligned to the roadmap. And I think once that's done, I think then the roadmap will then go through will go to cabinet for approval. And I think then Transnet will then ensure that they execute on its aligned turnaround plan to the roadmap. And I think what's important to outline as well to the Honourable Chair and Members is that we are also working through the National Logistics Crisis Committee to ensure that the various levers of the roadmap is executed through the various work streams. Honourable Chair and Members, thank you. That's it from me.
Okay, thank you. Any other response from National Treasury? Or I go to the next item?
Yes, Honourable Chair. On the conditional grants, I think the question was how do the conditional grants work? So the conditional grants are the allocations to the subnationals, to provinces or local government, which are in addition to the equitable share, which is the share that they receive of a national collected revenue to enable them to implement their mandate. So conditional grants is allocations, but on conditions that are given for specific policy areas in the department, that they feel that they need more targeted approach and support and oversight. So the money is allocated to departments who then allocate it to either the province or local government. So which means the department has got the responsibility to set proper policy and proper indicators in terms of what that conditional grants have got to achieve. And they have the responsibility to monitor the conditional grants. So the province or local government reports directly to departments and also to National Treasury on financial performance. And departments also report to us in terms of what the province and local government are reporting. So, but I think the important thing here is that the conditional grants give a direct responsibility on the national department to actually oversee the implementation and also support where support is required. So what has happened over the years is that departments have been allowed to implement what we call indirect grants. But these are direct grants. It sits in the budget of the municipality and the budget of the department, and municipality or province directly implement. So if if there is an indirect portion of it that is allowed, that often departments ask for that because of lack of capacity in either the department or the province or the municipality for them to implement on behalf of the municipality. So the idea is instead of
it losing the money, then the judicial department will do that. So that is what COCTA is trying to do now with some municipalities with regards to NIC. So, but the important thing is that departments need to be held responsible to performance. And so even in terms of identifying the municipalities that are not performing, I think it is actually, it will make much more a stronger case if the honorable members are also able to talk to the departments that are concerned in local government, the Department of Corporate Services with regards to MISA, with regards to NIC, to be able to then able to indicate why some of these municipalities, with the support that they are giving and that they have capacity to give, are still not performing, and what is it that can be done. I think it can actually be in much stronger engagement with this committee if that kind of approach can be adopted in trying to strengthen this accountability. So I think on the issue of the use of consultants, and I think the Auditor General raises this in the context of the preparation of financial statements, that some of those municipalities that have used consultants are still also do not have financial statements that are acceptable. Therefore, they end up with qualified audits. So it is a challenge, and part of the challenge is if municipalities don't adopt prudent financial management and proper recording of their transactions, it's going to be continue to be a problem. And what we have introduced now with M-Score, it is actually meant to make sure that the systems are actually automated, so that then you eliminate a lot of struggles that the municipalities have. But the challenge is the time also it is taking for them to actually adopt this, because I think because it is so good that it will also strengthen accountability and transparency. So in some cases, we are seeing the delays in actually institutionalization of M-Score. What I have also asked the Auditor General, though, is to say that the consultants that these municipalities use are professionals, and they are professional accountants, and who also have to follow certain ethical standards. So what I've asked is to say, couldn't they also be held accountable? Because how do you get hired to do the job, and then you don't actually deliver on that job? And also, if you are hired to do the job, that is impossible, because we understand that sometimes they have to reconstruct the records because they didn't keep proper records. So why are you not able to say, no, this can be done, instead of just spending the money for something that won't deliver? So I do think that some accountability needs to be in place so that then we can strengthen this on both sides. Thanks. I don't know, Jan, if you want to add. Thanks. Thanks, Chair.
Perhaps, Honourable Chair, if I can just add one or two points. So we largely agree with the Auditor General's view on the use of consultants. Our expectation, Chair, after 20 years of implementing the Municipal Finance Management Act, the municipality should 100% conform to the legal requirements. Therefore, they should have a capacity to produce these annual financial statements in-house themselves. And I think it's sometimes a convenient excuse to then bring in consultants that does not always add the value that Marijeng is referring to, Honorable Chair. Chair, whether we can completely eliminate that, I'm a bit skeptical, Chairperson. For instance, if your municipality is not blessed to have qualified engineers, then there's a probability that you'll have to use that type of skills in your water services, your electricity services. So as it stands, Chair, there's definitely a challenge. We did flag it, Honourable Chair, in our cost containment regulations that we've issued for municipalities. but it's an eloquent balance between having sufficient capacitated staff and then the contracted services that you use to render services where it's highly technical in nature. Thank you, Chairperson.
Thank you so much. I've got Honorable Nhlanhla. Honorable Nhlanhla, see your hand. Please come in.
Thank you very much, Chair. I thought we were done already. Sorry for my late hand. I just want to find out, Chair, what is National Treasury doing or any systems that they put in place to assist the country with the debt service cost? Because we are just seeing it rising and rising, and the country is just swindling in this debt, and that can't be good. So what systems are they putting in place as National Treasury to manage the debt of the country? Sorry. And then secondly, Chair, on the issues, it seems to me a National Treasury, whenever they need to cut budgets, they mainly focus or need to get money from somewhere, mainly focus on cutting on you know, these departments in terms of IT, as Honorable Dr. Mampoe said, IT equipment and things like that. And it seems to me there's no plan in as the country to raise this money or get money from other areas, like to, if we can ensure that we our corruption is not as high as it is, fraud is not as high as it is, I'm sure that money gets subsidized in the areas there where we need money. But to forever go to departments and cut on salaries, vacancies and things like that, it's not showing that they are having a clear plan as National Treasury or as these departments to ensure that we are having a fit and proper and healthy fiscus as the country. Thank you very much, Chair.
Thank you, Honorable Nhlanhla. Honorable Kaiso.
Yes, thank you very much, Chair. Just one question. I'm not sure whether will I be answered on the first question that I asked on the SARS spin-off. But then let me go to this question, if not a plea, because the issue of presidential employment stimulus package seemed to be working very well in the country. And for that project, I mean, it had inspired a number of young people, at least to get some job opportunities. Now, maybe it's proper that program, that presidential employment stimulus package, it be resourced such that now it's able to even absorb even beyond, you know, as many as young people as we can. So it is something that has shown that it has proved that it is able to impress, you know, upon our young people, you know, to keep them, you know, on doing something and for living at the same time, so as looking for, you know, permanent employment. But it has assisted our young people. So I just make this plea that it be resourced. Well, that's the only one way amongst the many ways that are there that have been done by the government that can assist our young people. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Honorable Kaiso, Honorable Nhlanhla. Those additional questions, as you deal with the presidential employment initiative, can you share with us what is the conversion rate from that to permanent employment? Thank you. Please come in. Muted if there's anyone who's trying to respond.
Thanks, Chairperson. I will ask Edgar to deal with the question on the revenue spill-off and the debt question. Just quickly on the presidential employment intervention, Chairperson, on that conversion rate, I will have to check with the presidency because they look after or they the collectors of the output information, but I will send you I'll send the committee the report, the updated report. I'll ask them for that. But in terms of allocation for this program, we understand the importance of the program, and in the MTBPS we did announce that it will continue. However, it will continue. The manner in which we're looking at funding this program is to look at the existing public employment programs and then assessing their efficiencies and their impact. And for those that don't have the desired impact, resources will then be reinforced to fund the presidential employment intervention. I think, Chairperson, what we tend to do as the state is we tend to add programs on top of existing programs without really, sometimes without, you know, assessing the ones that exist and ensuring that there is some value for money. So I think with this review of the public employment program, whether you're looking at EPWP or you're looking at the community work program, that will help us at least repurpose the funding to programs that have impact and have shown value for money. Edgar, on the other questions, are you on the call?
Yes, I'm on the call. Am I audible?
Yes, you are.
Okay, thank you. Through you, Chair, thank you for the opportunity. I hope I do justice to the question because I didn't hear all elements that the Honourable Member was raising. On the revenue side, I think what we have said is that we recognize and we indicated this at the time of the budget in February, that much of the improvement in revenues that have come in, tax revenues, has been because of the commodity cycle. In other words, in simple terms, the price of the minerals that South Africa sells to the rest of the world have had higher global prices for a couple of years. In February, we indicated that these prices are coming down, and therefore the revenue emanating from the mining industry will come down. We marginally reduced our estimates for revenue at the time because of this. However, we did not anticipate a much worse level of load shedding and a much worse level of the logistics challenges, in other words, the rail and port slowdowns that we saw this year. And quite frankly, Chair, nobody anticipated that level of slowdown. Every single projection that we looked at in February, obviously hindsight is 2020 vision, but at the time in February, nobody projected the level of load shedding that we saw. That we have seen up until now, and the level of rail and port slowdowns that we saw. Obviously, that compounded the revenue problem, which meant that the taxes that we thought we were going to collect were even lower than the lower estimates that we have put down in February. And that is the biggest single reason for the fiscal gap. Going forward, we have, of course, reduced our revenue estimates in order to be much more prudent in our thinking about what revenue looks like. At the same time, however, we will be announcing in February, we can't do it now because we don't make tax announcements in the MTBPS. We will be in February indicating very small, moderate sort of increases on the revenue side, in order to assist with the overall fiscal gap that has emerged, and these will be well targeted in terms of the current work that we're doing. On the issue of debt, I think, as we've indicated, Chair, the debt issue is a serious challenge. I would refer honourable members to Chapter 1, where we provide statistics and a statistical graph on how South Africa's debt has changed versus other countries, particularly emerging market countries around the world, and the speed at which this debt has increased. Therefore, illustrating that debt service costs have become not just the fastest item of spending, but with effect from the current year, the largest single item of spending of government. This for us underscores the need to, as the MTBPS says, this is the theme of the MTBPS, stay the course on fiscal consolidation in order to stop these debt service costs from rising. The policy that we are proposing in this MTBPS has been modeled to show that debt can stop, if we implement those policies, debt can stop growing in 2025-26, and in the year thereafter, debt service costs can start coming down. And that is the policy that we're proposing to Parliament in respect of the debt trajectory going forward. And finally, there was a statement in respect of wages that I heard from an honourable member. I think, honourable Chair, if you look at obviously the department-specific data will only come in February, but if you look at Chapter 4 of the MTBPS, it clearly shows, the as well as the next to see, it clearly shows that we're making additions to the compensation budget of key service delivery areas in government, specifically provincial education, provincial health, the police, defense force, as well as the correctional services, in order to assist them with that. In respect of the rest, of course, we're saying they must absorb the cost of the wage agreement of 2023. But it is important, Chair, to consider this proposal against what colleagues have been saying through this meeting, through this morning, which is that most departments routinely underspend on their compensation budget anyway. This has been happening for years. So there's a lot of slack in compensation budgets. And secondly, that there has been a growth in spending, as illustrated in Annexure B of the MTBPS, and I would kindly refer honourable members to take a very close look at Annexure B. There has been an increase in the administrative functions in government from which we think we can deprioritise, for lack of a better word, in order to improve the efficiency of the wage bill and compensation budget. Thank you very much, Honourable Chair.
Thank you.
Chair, I have a follow-up, please.
Okay. Right. Hi.
Chair, can I have a follow-up?
Yeah, that's fine. Can
Chair, sorry to enter the debate at this dead end. I'm not going to try and debate a policy formulation where it doesn't belong, which belongs to the space of cabinet, Nehotas, and political party policy conferences. I'm raising this matter, if not for the second time, the third time, about the projections we made of our GDP growth, because that's where the gist of the matter is. So I'm begging for the indulgence of the presenter. And the issue of where the graph lies in relation to your revenue shortfall, it's a debate for another space, because he raised a fundamental question, a question that suggests compensation is decreased. Now he basically says we need to get the size of the administration for us to be able to deal with the revenue shortfall, which is very limited still. Because least you also grow your revenue to be able to deal with the current shortfall and your needs and the projections to be able to have the reserves needed for any eventuality. You have not addressed the promise. And I want him to respond to that, because I want us to go beyond the current policy space and canvass more views on the tax base. so that we come to the next cycle, we've informed the position we take. And I'm not withstanding the fact that I will go and engage where I'm supposed to engage, Chair, but I'm throwing an issue for debate so that as we go, both the PGO and National Treasury go and debate and make a policy proposal for debate. I thank you for your indulgence.
Thank you, Honorable Tavias. NT, do you want to come in? Edgar?
Thank you very much, Honorable Chair, and thank you so much to the Honorable Member for the question. I don't think there's a disagreement between what the Honorable Member is saying and what we are indicating. We agree that we want and need revenue to be higher. There are some short-term measures, but those short-term measures don't fix the underlying problem. So, for instance, a very small 15 billion rand increase in revenue, which we indicated last week as being an initial measure, is a small measure. It's just part of something that needs to be done. But the bigger problem isn't that. The bigger problem, as the Honorable Member is indicating, is to grow the tax base. And the way that the tax base grows is for the economy to fundamentally grow and to grow much faster than it is right now. And this is a major part of the theme that we are presenting in respect of the NTBPS, where that needs to be the number one priority. And it is recognized as such from the first chapter of the NTBPS. And what that means, of course, is first addressing the things that have led to the revenue shortfalls in the first place, which I've already mentioned, the massive electricity shortages, the massive deterioration in the transportation of goods to market and through ports to international markets as well. These are the first sort of steps that need to be taken. And then beyond that, of course, other elements of the economic reform agenda, which, of course, as the Honorable Member is indicating, are currently being implemented through Cabinet. So, Chair, I just wanted to say, no, I think in general, those principles are not, in our view, as separate from each other. Thanks.
Thank you, Tim Treasury. I think I must let you go now. Thank you for the engagement. Obviously, the issues that economic issues that the country is facing have got a big impact on what we are trying to do as far as service delivery is concerned. I would just request Mampweni, you come back. Please also give us a historical performance of COE budget in the departments. If Edgar made to the point that in any case there's always an underspending in that area. If you could just give us a 5-year historical information as far as this budget item is concerned, that will also help the members to formulate their response to that. So this brings us to the end of the of this agenda item, and thank you very much. Good luck, National Treasury. We'll go to the next agenda item. Darren, the other one, the minutes will deal with them in the next meeting. Darren and Mashile, any announcements on our side?
Good day, Chairperson. Good day, Honourable Members. We are going to have the next meeting next Tuesday. We are meeting with the PBO with regards to the 2023 Adjustment Appropriation Bill. And we had apologies after the commencement of the meeting from Mr. Honourable Kwangwa, Honourable Murray, as well as Honourable Sheikh Imam. Thank you. This is what we had from our side.
Thank you so much.
Chairperson? Yes, Chairperson, sorry. Correction, Mr. Maria was in the meeting. It's just that he's been struggling with connectivity, so he was actually in the meeting. Thank you.
Okay, thanks, Darren.
Chairperson?
Yes,
just to check one thing, otherwise greetings. Mm-hmm. I wanted to check what's happening on Wednesday, Darren and Mr. Mashile. Aren't we in Parliament Wednesday afternoon? I'm just checking.
Response. Why that question, Honorable Mlenzani?
No, look, thinking aloud of these many bills that we have to deal with. Aren't we, I'm not sure. Is it the 15th or that Wednesday?
It looks like
we are lined up in the near future.
Okay, Aram Lindana. Thank you. Darren, can you please respond to that? What's the program saying? What's happening on?
On the 15th. Okay.
Chairperson, next Wednesday we are meeting with the FFC on these three bills that we dealt with today. Next week Wednesday and next week Tuesday we are meeting PBO also on the same bills. Yeah. But we are not meeting in the afternoons, Chairperson.
Yes.
No, thanks, Chair. Thanks.
Thank you. Honorable members, support staff, National Treasurer, every port on the platform, thank you very much for attending this meeting. The meeting is adjourned. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, Honorable members.
Long live the Chair.
Thank you. Members of NENCO, please remain on the platform. Five minutes. Let's meet. Members of NENCO. Need 5 minutes. Just take a comfort break of 5 minutes and then you must come back.